Welcome back to Editor's Picks from WAMU's Bluegrass Country in Washington, D.C. I'm Jared Walker. This week, we're highlighting a recent in-studio session with the three curators of a new exhibit at the Baltimore Museum of Industry, entitled Making Music, The Banjo in Baltimore and Beyond. Historians Greg Adams, Bob Winans, and Pete Ross joined host Rosemarie Nielsen to chat about the history of the banjo from the shores of West Africa to the workshops of Baltimore in the 1840s and 1850s.
So where do we want to go next?
Well, I think one of the things that maybe we could talk a little bit more about and then play some music as well, was to continue to talk about context. And one of the things that I would like to call attention to is that as we're looking at, for example, this regional history of the banjo, we have to remember that by the time of the American Civil War, for example, the banjo has been in American popular music for nearly 20 years. It is being played by African Americans, European Americans, Northerners, Southerners, professionals, and amateurs. And why was it popular amongst African Americans? Because it was their tradition. Why was it popular by the time of the Civil War with people of European descent? It is the phenomenon of blackface minstrelsy. And one of the things out the gate is, well, how do we talk about the racism, the appropriation, the treatment and the depictions of women in this whole process? And minstrelsy serves very much as a lens to look at broader culture and the dominant culture. And so what we're looking at in terms of the instrument, the playing technique, is the context of perhaps looking at some of the performances. We have these musical broadsides that tells you, you know, who's on stage, who's playing. We have a banjo solo, we have a banjo duo, a trio. We've also got a variety of instruments. Pete, I don't know if we'd mentioned this yet, but looking at the context of the minstrel ensemble, you've got not only the banjo, which was central to the ensemble, but the violin. You've got percussion instruments, the rhythm bones, the tambourine, and you have vocals. And so we have examples to kind of touch in all of those directions, and I think we should.
Okay.
Well, I've got some rhythm bones over here.
Okay.
Who's got some melody on a banjo?
Do you want to do...
Yes.
Bowman? So here's one that survives in the old-time tradition, which has become a tradition. We should talk about the rest of the exhibit. We'll get into that, sort of
yes.
Going back in a tradition. So how's it starting?
Well, I wanted to say, let's just do it as an instrumental, and then we can actually play the recording of yours so that people can hear the vocals with the harmonies and everything. Okay. So let's do an instrumental version.
Well, that is one of my favorite old-time songs, and I should let people know that when you know we were talking about how blackface minstrelsy was sort of that era's equivalent of an Elvis craze. The boatman was the bad boy of the culture. He, for one thing, in a really largely stay-put kind of a world, the boatman traveled a lot. And so there are words that go with this. I don't know what you want to say about those.
Yeah, we're going to be having a recording of Bob's, but I mean, before we listen to this recording, and you can talk more about the actual texture of the music, but we are essentially with the phenomenon of minstrelsy. You have white people donning burnt cork, trying to look black, wearing exaggerated clothing, using a faux black dialect to express themselves. And this is the foundation of American popular music. What does it sound like?
If we have that queued up for a boatman dance, this is from a recording that I made back in the 1980s. has a full ensemble, banjo, fiddle, bones, and tambourine, and a quartet of singers. So you'll hear the whole schmear of what minstrelsy was about.
Well, welcome back. This is Old Time Jam on WAMU's Bluegrass Country. I, of course, am Rosemarie Nielsen, and I am pleased to be here in the studio with the three co-curators of the new banjo exhibit at the Baltimore Museum of Industry. Just to refresh your memory, in case you tuned in late, I've got Greg Adams, Bob Winans, and Pete Ross with me. And we were, as we were listening to Boatman Dance, we were thinking about other things we'd better get cracking and start telling you. So, Greg, what would you like to talk about next?
Well, I would like to, I guess, mention in terms of the exhibit, you know, this is at the Baltimore Museum of Industry, and we've been very fortunate to get to work with them on this project. I would like to acknowledge that a part of the support that came to make this exhibit happen came through the Maryland State Arts Council. It also came through the Maryland Humanities Council, and we also have a series of private donors that helped to support bringing it together. But all of that infrastructure comes together to point towards what's actually in the exhibit.
This is Pete. The big stars of the exhibit are the banjos. There are 15 banjos in there. All but one, I made the reproduction that's at the opening exhibit. The rest are from 1840s and 50s Baltimore. And the three of us are used to seeing these kind of banjos because we study it. You know, it's what we do with our lives. But and we know the guys they belong to. But most of them are in private collections, so you really rarely get to see them. I don't think any banjo. I don't think any exhibit has had this many banjos from this era, regardless of the maker, at one time. We also have a lot of supporting material. There's broadsides from near minstrel shows that took place in Baltimore. There's other sheet music from the 1840s. Back to the 1820s, even, we have images of the banjo and sheet music. And we have, was it about a dozen photographs? There are carte de visites, ambrotypes, and tintypes of people playing Boucher banjos that are in the cases there. You can see how prevalent the banjos were. We also have reproductions of two large pieces of art where Boucher banjos were clearly the model. This is fine art, not popular art, but they clearly feature Boucher banjos.
I've seen some, not necessarily the ones that are on display in Baltimore, but there was another art exhibit of banjo art. And one thing I thought was very, it was at the Corcoran a few years back.
Picturing the banjo.
It was picturing the banjo, but the interesting thing is once you become a banjo player, you see that often the artists actually got the interaction between the human hand and the banjo wrong.
We think these guys did pretty good.
I'll be very interested to go to Baltimore myself and see the art as well as the banjos. And of course, the banjos, as you just said, the banjos really are the star. But
So we have the imagery in the exhibit that's people in blackface with banjos, but then the photographs are all people that don't feel like they need to put on that costume anymore. And then the final group of banjos in the exhibit are basically thrashed, wrecked, and then restored banjos. They're interesting in their own right, just because there aren't many banjos from that era, but it also goes to show that at this point, this is why we put it there, it had re-entered the vernacular at this point. It was just something that people had in their lives, an object they observed every day, and made part of the music they generated on their own. The fad had passed, but these instruments had become important to the lives of everyday people.
So they would repair them and replace parts in order to keep playing them.
There's a couple of whole new necks on them, some beautiful examples of folk art in that way, and some that are basically stapled together with pieces of brass. Parts of the fingerboard are replaced where the fingers had worn through.
And then that tradition, I mean, I don't know, does the exhibit stop at a particular time?
The exhibit is largely focused on 18th and 19th century history. One of the things that we're planning on doing outside of the physical exhibit is organizing ancillary programming that seeks to recognize the ways in which the banjo continues to live as a Maryland tradition today, whether they're people that come from the state of Maryland or people that have moved to the area.
Something about where the banjos turned up. This is not really in the exhibit. These banjos turn up all over the country. And for years I had thought somebody bought them on the East Coast in one of the large urban areas, and then it sort of filtered down through pawn shop, used stuff shops. But then as we're doing the research, a friend of ours had actually laid out for us where all the travel routes were for commercial objects leaving Baltimore, and they go throughout the South as well as into the Midwest and New York. Most of these turn up in, I guess, sort of the upper South, Virginia, North Carolina, West Virginia.
Yeah, there's a real Appalachian sense of these banjos became part of the Appalachian music scene, these Boucher banjos, through this travel, this merchandising route down the Susquehanna.
So they went directly to these places. They didn't they didn't just get sold in Baltimore.
Yeah.
Well, and that I'm an amateur musician. I will always be an amateur musician, but pretty avid, I think. And when you start to use, the word folk music, it turns out that's a really complicated
term. We try
term.
To avoid it.
Yes,
there's no substitute.
I've expunged that word from my vocabulary unless I'm referencing somebody else calling it the folk revival, mm-hmm. or they describe themselves that way. Because it's very problematic. I mean, we can know the identities of real people in this process. And how do we dig down to do that?
This is something that's difficult for people who come to old-time music out of a passion for that stuff. I think it's sort of, even that's loaded, I like a lot of people got into it, think like, all right, I'm going to this pure music. It's just generated by the folk, by the mm-hmm. common people. And you realize rarely, very quickly that marketplace was part of this the whole way. And it's painful maybe a little bit at first, but that's really just part of the American story.
Well, once you get over that though, sometimes we who might, be called folk music fans don't realize that some of the folk musicians, they didn't really care how authentic it was. They were just trying to make their sound.
Right.
Well, we are running a little bit out of time, so we need to talk before we get to anything else, how can people who have heard this show get more information, and how can they get themselves to Baltimore?
Well, you can look on the Baltimore Museum of Industry's website. They will post things about the different events that will be taking place as they're scheduled. Another place, if you're on Facebook, we do have a Facebook page that's specifically for Making Music, the Banjo in Baltimore and Beyond. And then we'll be working on publicizing. I mean, they've got rack cards out. Things are being published in the local newspapers, but we are going to also continue working on a stronger web presence as well.
Oh, good. Well, some of your reviews already, though, I must say, have been quite good.
Excellent. Well, I mean, so I think, you know, we're coming into the home stretch of our time with you. This is really great. I've got, I guess, one more thing I would like to say from a philosophical point of view, and I think we should get back into playing music. Yeah. As we're looking at the fact that Maryland is still very much a home of banjo traditions, the big thing that we're after with this exhibit is, because we're looking at slavery, minstrelsy, the impact and power of industrialization, we are seeking to create essentially a safe space where everybody, regardless of their background, can come and take a look at these materials and find a way to have an inclusive, critical, and unapologetic conversation about this history. The second thing that we want to have come out of this is that people can come to this exhibit and feel like they can take some sort of personal ownership over this history. And we want people to ask the questions, you know, does this exhibit go too far, or does it not go far enough in exploring these critical issues, whether we're talking about race, ethnicity, class? These are all issues that impact everybody.
So we open up with the Elvis parallel. When you see this history, you see the pattern of the co-optation of the music of African Americans or another sort of fill-in subcultural group, it's absorbed, it's commodified, and then it's reabsorbed back into the vernacular or the folk or whatever we're going to call it. You start seeing this pattern everywhere, and it's really interesting. You wonder, is the minstrel show this weird cultural fixation that we keep returning to again and again throughout our cultural history?
It's a pattern. It's a continual pattern. Yeah. And as Greg had already described it, the minstrel show provides us really with the first innings of a truly American popular music, which immediately got exported, as a matter of fact.
I was going to say it was an international craze, as I understand.
It was an international craze. It was important in that regard, and the co-optation, the appropriation is all part of that. And there are other elements embedded in the minstrel material that bear fruit later on. There are a number of, there's a whole subset of tunes within minstrelsy that demonstrate various kinds of syncopation. Well before syncopation becomes really important in American music with ragtime, which comes at the end of the 19th century. Now, I'm not saying that syncopation within minstrel banjo music is what caused syncopation and ragtime, but they're related. There is a progression that moves from one to the other, and the syncopation in the minstrel tunes is evidence that where the minstrel show, however much it was racist, and it was, is also very much depending on the pre-existing African-American instrument and the ways of playing it.
I'm so glad you brought that up, and I won't talk long, but I have to say, to my ear, I've listened to Greg's CD by the band Homefront, if I may say, and I've played that on the show many times, and sometimes I've gotten listener comments that it is how modern it sounds. And it took a while for some of that syncopation to percolate through later American music and then into the Appalachian old-time tradition that I mostly focus on in this show. But some of this music was really quite revolutionary, at least from the point of view of Europeans. Anyway, let me stop because we're running out of time and we need more banjo.
We're going to play a syncopated banjo tune, Peepatch Jig.
Excellent.
Thank you.
it should be pointed out that they are actually playing two separate versions of the same tune. Again, both of them from period pieces, and we decided that it really made a really interesting piece just to layer them over one another and see if they actually fit together.
And time-wise, these two versions came from about the 1830s or 1850s and 60s.
Something like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the interesting thing about this, too, is that there is this kind of revived interest in how do we look at all of the paper music from this time, which captures aspects of vernacular tradition as well as the commercial tradition. And this melody shows up in different ways, and it's just really great to overlay
them. Different names.
Exactly. Yeah. So from Rattlesnake Jig to Pea Patch Jig to the Great Eastern Jig, depending on which source you look at. Right.
Well, we have just a few more minutes. Do you have another one you'd like to play?
Yes.
You want to do Jim Long Josie?
Yes.
Oh, wonderful.
So this is a tune that was published as early as 1840 called Jim Along Josie.
Will this be a banjo trio?
Yes, we'll do this as a trio.
Now, see, only on Old Time Jam on WAMU's Bluegrass Country are you likely to hear three fretless banjos played
together.
Right,
so we are exploring the sonic possibilities as would have been presented on the stage.
Should get everybody's toes tapping. It just about got mine tapping, and then I remembered we're live on the air, and that will be picked up by our wonderful mics. Well, thank the three of you very, very much for coming in. And in our last minute and a half that we have here, Greg, if people want more information about you or your research or your music.
Right. Well, I guess I don't have a formal webpage, but if you Google Greg Adams Banjo, you'll see where I show up in a lot of different places. If you go to Homefront's webpage, it's homefrontmusic.com, I think. Anyway, the band has tolerated all of my banjo stuff. They have a page on that dedicated to the things I've done.
And I do have a webpage. It's called Winans Banjo. So if you just Google Winans Banjo, you'll get to that. And
can you tell people how to spell Winans, please?
Sure.
Yeah.
It's Winans. Winans Banjo, capital W, capital B is all one word. And I've done a lot of research over the years and published many papers about banjo-related topics, and pretty much all of that is available on the website, along with a lot of other banjo-related stuff.
Okay, and you, Pete?
I'm at banjopete.com, where you can see some of the banjos I've made. Get in touch with me. It's severely out of date, but now that the exhibit is up and running, I may have time to update that.
And it might be time.
Yeah.
Because I think we might be in, I have a rich fantasy life. I like to think that this is a golden age of the banjo in its own way.
We are just a small... We are a trio of a larger group of people that have very deep concerns. We are not the only people doing research on this. We have people like Shlomo Pesco in New York, Tony Thomas in Florida, Laurent Dubois down at Duke University. We are part of a network building the infrastructure to make this history more apparent.
And if I can say, just as a fan, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Historians Greg Adams, Bob Winans, and Pete Ralls, with host Rosemarie Nielsen, recorded on April 4th, 2014. Our audio engineer was Jared Walker. Our theme music is Sunday Morning Reel by Joe Walsh. Editor's Picks is a production of WAMU's Bluegrass Country in Washington, D.C. I'm Jared Walker.